Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton just came down explicitly to reinforce, like 3 days ago, saying textually, I'm a fan of the Calderon drug war, and that the United States would continue to pour money into it, even when there's evident civil society movement against it, and when the results have been absolutely disastrous.
That's the voice of Laura Carlson reporting from the border city of Juarez, Mexico, speaking about Plan Meridia and the war on drugs. We speak to her today during her protest about the impunity of which both organized crime and the state show towards the rule of law and what that means for the average Mexican, especially the cost to women. We also speak to Sarah Michalenko, editor of Upside Down World, about how the U.S. is using Colombia, the worst human rights violator in the hemisphere, as a model for the militarization of Mexican society. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged to have Laura Carlson. She's the director of CIP Americas. She is reporting from the city of Juarez in Mexico, where she is about to begin a march with a number of women. Welcome to our show, Laura.
Good morning, Sylvia. We're right along the border here between Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, Texas, an event against the violence that's taken over this city. We're following in a caravan behind a truck. You can hear the toll of a bell. This bell was used this morning to toll for the 16 youth that were killed exactly a year ago in the neighborhood of Villa Sarbarca here in Ciudad Juarez. Right now, this group is going to the border where we're going to stage a binational protest. This includes groups and organizations from the United States, from the Juarez area, and from El Paso and beyond and other points in the United States to protest against the violence that's come to characterize this part of the border area.
Let's talk a little bit about that. When George Bush finally left the White House, the world seemed to be relieved that we were having a change, a wave of change was on the horizon. Has there been any change in terms of the national security policies that have raised this militarism in Mexico?
Many of us who've been watching this situation have been very disappointed with the Obama administration. Even though we knew from the campaign that there was considerable support for the Bush-Merida initiative, which is an initiative to essentially militarize Mexico with the pretext of counter-terrorism and counter-narcotics activities, we still didn't expect that there would be this level of support. What we've seen is that the three-year Bush-Merida initiative has been extended indefinitely by the Obama administration, and it's been funded at levels that go way beyond what Bush himself asked for. The result of this is this drug war model being imposed, which is a model that's based on interdiction and enforcement that practically ignores questions like consumption, rehabilitation, prevention, dismantling financial structures, and focuses on an open confrontation. That open confrontation, it's what led to this huge increase in the violence within Mexico, and particularly here in Ciudad Juarez, which ironically is the laboratory for the application of this model that rests basically on sending in military troops to fight the drug cartels.
Let's talk a little bit about the significance this has had in the lives of women. We now hear reports of murdered women in the Ciudad Juarez in alarming numbers. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between the militarism to protect the maquiladoras and the connection to the drug trafficking industry?
So this has been one of the most tragic aspects because, as you know, the problem of femicides goes back to about 17 years when it was first discovered that there was a pattern of murder of vulnerable young women in particular. And this court case called the Cotton Fields actually went to the Inter-American Human Rights Court, and it was decided that the Mexican government has been negligent in following up on these cases, and this puts these women at constant risk. So the number annual of femicides has continued until the drug war begins here in Ciudad Juarez, and then what we find is that there's a huge increase. You look at the number last year, and it was 300 women killed, an enormous increase from the numbers prior. It's hard to say exactly what's going on because the number one problem here is that these are cases that are not even fully investigated and that they're not prosecuted. The complete lack of interest, which many believe and with certain much evidence is actually complicity on the part of the authorities, is an obstacle, and it's also what creates the ability for people for probably varying reasons to continue to murder women in this city and in this area. When you have a situation of such a violence that's generalized within Ciudad Juarez as a result of the drug war, where it's now commonplace to have scores of assassinations a day or a week, then this puts women at greater risk. For one thing, it creates a cover-up for people who kill women. They can either claim that it was organized crime, or it can be organized crime. It creates a climate of violence in which violence flourishes for the many different reasons that these crimes are being carried out. And then the other, and of course this is a particular concern to many people, is that there's indications that we know, in fact, that women human rights activists are being targeted in some cases. There was a famous case that I wrote about recently where a woman, Maricela Escobedo, her daughter was murdered. She had a good idea who murdered her boyfriend. The authorities showed little or no interest in actually investigating or prosecuting the case. She took it upon herself to hunt him down, to find him, to bring him to justice. Three judges absolved him despite a confession, which gives you an idea of a classic case of the kind of impunity and corruption that characterizes the justice system here. She went back and had a retrial or a new trial. He was actually prosecuted, but by this time he was long gone. Her crusade didn't end there despite all the obstacles and that she had. She continued to protest, and on December 16th, she was protesting outside the state capitol and was shot in the head.
Talk a little bit about the common occurrence of finding young women murdered, often raped and tortured, the connection to the law court's apathy to persecute the assailants.
One of the interesting things here is that a lot of people were saying that the legal institutions had been eroded by organized crime. There's an emphasis always on the part of the federal government and all levels of government to say that the terrible instances of impunity and violence that we're seeing in places like Juarez are all attributable to organized crime. But what the femicides show us is that impunity within the state predates the violence of organized crime, and in fact is a precondition for the flourishing of the operations of organized crime here. And it's certainly a precondition and in fact an invitation to the flourishing of gender-based crimes. This has been an allegation since it was first discovered that there was a pattern of gender-based crimes, hideous murders and torture, as you mentioned, within Ciudad Juarez, and that continuing under the cloak of this impunity. There's speculation as to a number of different reasons that the perpetrators of domestic violence simply know they can get away with it. When you have the cases that are characterized by torture, there's a lot of speculation that they're related to snuff films and the worst and lowest and most heinous types of pornography rings. There's indication that there are government officials that are linked directly to profiting off of these types of murders. It's a no man's land, but even more a no woman's land, in which these young women who work at the maquiladoras, who are poor, who have very little defenses and are put in a vulnerable position because they're leaving work at late hours with problems of housing and transportation, become easy prey to all kinds of the very worst types of elements of human society you could imagine.
Talk a little bit about the protest today. You mentioned there were 16 youth that were murdered. Who were they, and what do you hope the population would do in response to these crimes?
Well, I think the fact that this protest is taking place already demonstrates that there has been a response to this crime in particular. It happened, as I say, just a year ago. A commando went into a party of teenagers, mostly, who were celebrating a birthday, opened fire, and murdered 16, some other people. This really shook up Mexican society, not only here in Juarez, but on a nationwide basis, because it represented raising the level of the drug war to a new level of violence and a new level of vulnerability, and particularly a new level of vulnerability and violence against youth. What also happened is that the first response from President Felipe Calderón was to say that these youth were somehow linked to organized crime. This was before there was any type of investigation whatsoever, and this absolutely enraged the families, as you can imagine. Not only was the government not protecting and didn't protect their children who were mourning in this precise moment, but the president comes out saying, accusing them of something he has no information about, and thereby implicitly justifying their massacre. So he had to come to Ciudad Juarez and try to do damage control after that, and when he did, things just got worse. Or in terms of the civil society perspective, better, because the mothers stood up to him and protested and called him insensitive and said, your security policy is not working. We demand our right to be secure in our communities, and we demand justice for our children. These women have continued to be active in the movement. They were there this morning at the protest. What's happened since then, in the year that's followed that massacre, is the civil society movement to protest the violence and to say this drug war is not working, and in fact it's making us all more vulnerable, and we have to find another strategy, has grown stronger and stronger. There have been more and more civic initiatives on the part of human rights groups, on the part of women's groups, on the part of student groups. They've come closer together as they realize that they're all joined together in this growing climate of violence that threatens them, and they begin to formulate demands in common. At this bi-national event, some of the demands include an end to the violence and that justice be served to the victims and their families, especially in Ciudad Juarez and Chihuahua. Insist that everyday life and peace be reestablished, and end to criminality, whether from the state, drug traffic organizations, gun dealers, smugglers, gangs, police, or the military. And of course, the reason that they put all those together, which according to the government are both good guys and bad guys, is that the lines between the supposed good guys and bad guys have been completely blurred in a situation where there's so much violence and so much corruption as there is in Ciudad Juarez. They go on to say, we blame the U.S. and Mexican policies for the chaos, namely the futile war on drugs, Calderón's Todos Somos Juarez, which is the strategy here in Juarez, and the U.S. Merida Initiative, which I mentioned is the policy that's backing up and funding the drug war here, model here in Mexico, and which, incidentally, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton just came down explicitly to reinforce like 3 days ago, saying textually, I'm a fan of the Calderón drug war, and that the United States would continue to pour money into it, even when there's evident civil society movement against it, and when the results have been absolutely disastrous.
Thank you so much for being with us. Laura Carson is a correspondent from Latin American Trade Magazine, freelance writer and researcher. She's also a co-founder of CIP Americas program. Tell us a little bit about work your organization does and how can people support it.
I'm based in Mexico City. The webpage is really the center of our work. It's where we put our analysis and information. And that webpage is at www.cipamericas.org. So we both track U.S. foreign policy within Latin America and the impact it has on people and on communities, and also the response of communities and grassroots organizations and movements against militarization, for fair trade, and to organize to create self-determination and real democracy in the Latin American countries.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvia. Bye-bye.
Take care. That was Laura Carson reporting from the border of Mexico City in the city of Juarez. The militarization of the streets of many Latin American countries and the increasing militarization of our streets here in Canada and the U.S., where the poor are criminalized rather than recognizing the structures of injustice that produce the poor, need to be addressed. Someone who's been looking at the link between militarization and violence in Mexico is Ciro Micolaco. He is co-founder of Upside Down World, a wonderful news magazine, and we're very privileged to have him this morning. Welcome to our show, Ciro.
Thank you, Sylvia.
We were speaking earlier with Laura Carson in Mexico, where she is at a demonstration rejecting the United States' ongoing intent to continue to fund the Merida project, which has been increasingly one of the integral tools to the increasing violence and militarization of Mexico. Tell us a little bit about your own findings of the connection between militarization and violence and the ongoing violation of human rights.
What we're seeing really is an extension of U.S. policy for the region in Mexico, specifically with the Merida Initiative, or what is often referred to as Plan Mexico. Back in 2008, Washington signed a $1.6 billion security package towards the Mexican government in order for them to, quote-unquote, fight the war on drugs. Now, last Saturday, the Washington Post came out with an article revealing that Colombian police commandos were now training Mexican troops and police in counterinsurgency methods, and as well as Colombian officials were also training Mexican court officials. The problem with this is just the horrendous human rights record, not only of Colombia, but of Mexico. You know, in Colombia, we had, you know, the president that was Álvaro Uribe, who just finished his two terms and was succeeded by his defense minister. He's being investigated by a Colombian congressional commission for using that country's Department of Administrative Security, which would be like akin to the FBI in the United States, to spy on Supreme Court justices, rival politicians, human rights organizations, etc. You know, then the Colombian military and police have a horrendous human rights record, you know, documented by diverse organizations, you know, ranging from the Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, to even our Washington's own State Department. One of the big scandals that have come up in the last couple years is the false positive scandal, where Colombian military were killing innocent men and dressing them up as rebels. The way the Colombian government had it set up is the soldiers were rewarded for kills. So for the amount of kills the soldiers would get, they could qualify for bonuses, promotions, and time off. And just the fact that Washington would, you know, tout Colombia as a model for Mexico and the rest of the region is just horrifying. And this development of Colombia's growing role in the region is something that should not only trouble Latin Americans, but people in the North who believe that cooperation, solidarity, peace, and justice should be the guiding principles of foreign relations in the hemisphere.
Not only is Colombia not to be used a model, but it should be a warning of, you know, what has been taking place there in terms of the many social movements that are constantly being attacked by the military. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the connection between the militarism and the regions that are particularly impacted by it, which in previous reports seems to be correlated to U.S. interests, whether it be maquilas or whether it be areas where high trafficking takes place.
One has to start thinking about what the actual motivations are behind Washington pushing the militarization of the region. You know, first of all, because, you know, it's obviously not an effective method to fighting the war on drugs. You know, if that were the case, Colombia still wouldn't be the leading producer of cocaine in the world, as The Economist pointed out a few weeks ago. After 10 years of ever-increasing military aid to the region. You know, I think what we're seeing here is this is Washington's way of countering the more progressive developments that have been taking place in the last 10 to 15 years in the region. You know, now we're seeing more and more center-left and left-wing governments, you know, despite the complexities and contradictions they may have with some of the relations with social movements within their own countries. You know, one of the things that we've seen is, you know, largely across the region and on a pretty unified front is that, Latin America has finally reasserted its sovereignty, thus challenging the idea of the region being America's backyard, which Washington has traditionally viewed it as, dating back to the days of Manifest Destiny. You know, if it's not to fight the war on drugs, one of the reasons why Washington would be pushing this militarization, which often leads to the repression of social movements, is to advance its commercial interests. Back in 2000, as we were signing Plan Colombia, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists reported in a study that major U.S. oil companies had lobbied Congress in Washington to promote additional military aid in order to secure investments in that region and create a better climate for further exploration of Colombia's reserves. The organization reported that corporations had lobbied almost $100 million to affect Latin American policy in the run-up to that. Now you're seeing Barack Obama, President Obama, talking about signing a free trade agreement with Colombia. So I think that there's this symbiotic relationship between militarism and U.S. commercial interests in the region.
In the case of Uribe, we've known he is well known as a criminal in Colombia, while Hillary Clinton praises him as being a great model of a democratic leader, which seems to contradict all logic when you think about the kinds of crimes that have been committed in Colombia. But draw the correlation to Mexico, because Obama is now doing similar with Mexico. He's praising democracy in Mexico, while Human Rights Watch seem to defer. Can you talk about the numbers of people that have been killed, which in its majority seems to be an increasing number of civilians?
In reference to Mexico, with Calderon, after he was elected and an election tainted with a bunch of irregularities and fraud, Calderon decided to use the military front and center in the so-called war on drugs and increase their responsibilities with that. Since that's taken place, according to Mexican government's own numbers, over 35,000 people have been killed in the war on drugs in Mexico since 2006. 172% increase of civilian deaths from 2009 to 2010. What's also troubling is there's Latin American Herald Tribune pointed out that, like in Colombia, Mexico's military is using false positive methods to cover up civilian deaths. And like in Colombia, there's just institutionalized impunity. There's no accountability for hardly any of these crimes. There is no justice. And Washington refuses to do anything or say anything or raise any of these questions about human rights to these governments. The irony in that is, you know, we don't have much of a moral standing anymore to criticize anyone on human rights, but if we were to do that, I mean, one, we should not be funding this, and two, you know, if we were to criticize them, we would have to have a caveat saying we would do our best to stop our own human rights abuses. And I guess the only other thing that I thought was interesting was that you know, Human Rights has their annual report that they put out every year, and they pointed out that there's been 1,100 complaints of human rights abuses filed against the Army with Mexico's National Human Rights Commission in the first 6 months of last year. So this is the type of situation that Washington has helped create, President Obama has helped create with this militarization plan, Plan Mexico. And, you know, essentially President Obama has just continued President Bush's foreign policy, because this was initially or originally his initiative.
In your article, you talk about how the U.S. is increasing their funding, while at the same time there is some concerns of widespread corruption and low prosecution rates. Can you talk about the impact that this is having in terms of the kinds of policies that are being implemented on a local level in terms of policing and the kinds of crimes that are being committed in certain parts of Mexico?
Sure. I mean, there was a couple, you know, cables released by WikiLeaks that showed that privately Washington was expressing concerns about the, you know, inability of the Mexican military to actually effectively do policing work, effectively fight against the drug cartels, raising questions about the human rights abuses. And I think what that does, and, you know, what the beauty of WikiLeaks does, it shows tangible evidence about the, you know, the hypocrisy and duplicity of U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, it gives tangible evidence, at least from, you know, many critics of Washington on the left, that shows that, you know, what they've been saying all along is Washington says one thing but means another. You know, human rights, justice does not take a priority with U.S. foreign policy. If it did, you know, then those private concerns would be made public, and there would be a complete reversal of U.S. policy in regards to, you know, Plan Mexico and Plan Colombia.
It's like extinguishing a fire with gasoline. It's the term you use in your article. What can people do? What can citizens who are concerned about the ongoing funding of U.S. aggression, I would call it, in Mexico through the Plan Merida, of U.S. involvement and intervention in South America, preventing social movements, people who are concerned about their government's actions, what can they do?
I guess a few things. One is, you know, obviously first is educating yourself and, you know, getting up to date on what the issues are, which, you know, involves obviously going beyond the mainstream media. Past that, you know, there's so many issues that many people are working on, you know, depending on your time. One thing you could do would be support grassroots organizations that do solidarity work in these various countries that are combating U.S.-led militarism and oppression against social movements. You know, in addition to that, you know, obviously you could go more mainstream routes of lobbying with government officials, you know, but as far as that goes here, at least in, you know, I can speak for the United States, you know, the Democrats and Republicans are, you know, equally guilty and equally, you know, responsible for these policies. And then just trying to raise awareness, you know, in maybe some mainstream media, newspapers and publications as well, challenging any kind of articles that they have put out that might not be giving a full and clear picture of the whole story about what these types of policies mean and what types of impacts that they have for people on the ground. I mean, 35,000 people dead since 2006. That's a staggering number. And there was one political analyst that suggested that if it continues, if the violence continues at the rate it's going now, it could be 75,000 people by the end of next year. So those would be a few things that I think that people could do to try to get involved and get engaged, in the fight for peace and justice, and, you know, throughout the hemisphere.
Cyril Mikulenko is the editor and co-founder of Upside Down World. How can people support your work?
He's at upsidedownworld.org, and you can sign up for a free weekly newsletter where you'll receive the week's features, news briefs, and analysis, and just spread the word.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Take care.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.